The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So good morning, everyone. I have, a couple of announcements. One is that you'll find at the counter by the door as you go out our annual fundraising letter. In the letter, I mentioned that this is marking the 10th anniversary of being here at IMC. It's quite something to be here for this long. And I know many people don't like to get fundraising letters, and let alone pick one up voluntarily. But they're there if you'd like to read what I wrote. And also, it's quite remarkable for 10 years that we have this center here that we don't charge for anything, and we have no official membership where people pay. So it's quite. I don't know how many places in the world there are that are like this. It's kind of unusual, and it has been historically over these last 10 years quite a significant source of our funds. Is the money that comes in from that end of the year fundraising letter. Though even only a small percentage of people come here are actually on the mailing list, because Some people don't. Why would they bother being on the mailing list? So if you're interested at all, that's the letters there. And I want to tell you a little story. That we received a phone call this week from someone who received the fundraising letter, and it was Ruth Dennison. And Ruth Dennison is the most senior Vipassana teacher, insight meditation teacher in the United States. I think she started teaching in the 60s and. She must be in her 90s. It's always some controversy about how old she is. But, she must be in her 90s. And she called up and said, congratulations on your 10th year anniversary of being in Redwood City. She was, expressed her happiness for all that. And then said, I'm sorry that I can't afford to make a donation. But getting that congratulations from Ruth Dennison, I thought was so beautiful. She lives in Southern California, and I don't know her that well. We know each other a little bit. We've seen each other over the years, here and there. So as for the kind of Dharma talk today, if you go back, those of you who are coming regularly, over the last few months, I did a 4-week series on generosity, and then a talk on intention, followed by a talk on desire, and then on fear, and then on compassion. And then in between there, Carla Brennan came and also gave a talk on compassion or self-compassion, I think. So that's a long time, a series of talks. And I thought that rather than giving a talk today, which I'm quite capable of doing, if nothing else but happens, but I thought it would be really nice now to give you a chance to speak in the form of, if you have any questions, any issues that are up for you in the practice of your engagement with Buddhism or something related. It's nice for me, certainly, to hear your questions, find out what's going on for you. And also, I think it's very helpful for the community to hear the kind of concerns and questions and things that are on people's minds. We kind of learn about each other as well. I think it's an important function of being here together as a community. Let's get to know each other some. And we're so big Sunday morning, it's hard to kind of break up into small groups that we do occasionally, so you get to talk, discuss the Dharma together. But perhaps we can do this as a question format today, questions and answers or questions and responses. I'll do my best to respond. If you could... I see already hand. Can you hear in the outer hall okay?
Yes. Well, speaking of giving and Donna, I feel discombobulated a bit because I cannot give what I would like to give. Ruth Dennison said she couldn't give, and sometimes I can't either, but I can't, it's hard for me to be at ease with that inability to give, and there are so many worthy causes. So I don't know if you have anything to say to that.
So, you know, we're the kind of bottom line in some ways for our tradition here is some ways mindfulness. So it would be to be mindful of what goes on inside of you when you feel discombobulated, when you feel that tension between your desire and your ability. Because probably there's a number of interesting things happening there for you. I don't know you well enough to know, but I can imagine that for some people, the feeling a need in the world touches a sense of responsibility. It's up to me to do something, or touches our sense of our identity issues. Right? You know, certainly the world is watching me, and you're supposed to be a good person. You're supposed to, you know, and so there's kind of a sense of obligation to respond. It could also be that it touches, you know, the needs of the world touches our compassion, which is a beautiful thing, and the desire to help, which is a beautiful thing. But then sometimes it gets mixed up with feelings of inadequacy or feelings of hurt or feelings of fear. There's sometimes unresolved issues that are behind our compassion or connected to our compassion. And so it could be a very rich area to look at. As I said in my series of talks on generosity, there's no obligation in Buddhism to give, and the Buddha encouraged people to give in ways that bring us delight, and to give in such a way it doesn't harm ourselves. So if you give everything you have away, you'd harm yourself, and harming yourself that way, you'd probably harm our society as well. So there has to be some wisdom and care in the giving. I think that rather than focusing on what we give, in terms of, you know, money and stuff like that, or time or whatever we might give, that I think it's beautiful to celebrate the urge to help, the urge to give, the urge to be supportive in whatever form it takes, and then to consider what would be a good way to do that, given all the causes and conditions, given what I'm able to do. And so for Ruth Dennison, it was a phone call that cheered me up. You know, wow, Ruth Dennison calls, and that's pretty fantastic. And, you know, I felt her encouragement and support. And in some ways, that counted for me more than if she'd sent, you know, $20 or something, whatever she could have sent, just, you know, to actually take the time to call and, you know. And so so there's sometimes other ways we can give. And then there's all those causes, and, you know, there's so many things in the world that we feel called to respond to. And it doesn't make sense to respond to everything, all the suffering of the world. No one person can do it. And the way that I respond to something like that is I see the causes and the needs in the world. And I'm inspired by it, I'm moved by it, and would like to respond. And I respond indirectly. I respond by, I can't do it all, but my way is I take that energy or that intention I have and channel it into trying to do better what I can do. So, for example, you're a volunteer here at IMC, which is a beautiful thing you do, and and, you know, you can't perhaps help, you know, put a lot of time and effort in helping things in other places in the world, but to give a little bit more, you know, not that you need to, but a little bit more oomph behind your volunteering here, your greeting new people, that makes a difference locally, and that energy of yours to help elsewhere can be channeled in here, and who knows how that ripples out. How does that sound as a long-winded answer?
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Helps
is
a lot.
Is it more that you want to ask? Or?
No, not right now. Thank you.
Okay. It might be nice also if people said their names, maybe first name. Or Say your name as well, maybe as you.
My name's John. I wonder about Buddha came first, then Jesus, and then Muhammad.
And then you. And I don't say that as a joke.
No. But has Buddhism evolved, including those teachings over time?
Has Buddhism evolved, incorporating some of those later teachings over time? I don't know about that. I mean, historically, down through the centuries until the modern era, there wasn't a lot of contact of influence from those religions towards Buddhism. There's some idea that there's a little bit of Zoroastrianism in Mahayana Buddhism. It's a kind of ancient Persian religion that still exists a teeny bit here and there. And Zoroastrianism also influenced Christianity and Judaism, they say, kind of spread out from Persia into these other religions. And there's a kind of some popular ideas that float around that, you know, Jesus spent his lost years in Kashmir studying Buddhism.
You know,
so there, you know, every once in a while you see references to this kind of idea, and there is in Catholicism, they had a couple of saints, Catholic saints. I forget exactly how their names, Bartholomew and Josephat, I think, something like that. And it turns out, and there's you know that these saints that they're no longer they've been desainted now, because it was discovered that these two saints were kind of the way that Game of Telephone plays out. If you go backward through the telephone call, it refers to the Bodhisattva, to the Buddha when he was a Bodhisattva. And there's been this careful study that shows down through the ages and the ancient texts going backwards how there's a slow transformation from the Buddha to these two Catholic saints. And the story connected to the saints are kind of like the story of the Buddha's life, apparently. So in the late 1800s, when this was discovered, these saints were quickly defrocked. They say there's maybe some influence from Islam into Tibetan Buddhism, some theory about that. I believe the Kali Chakra Sutra, Kali Chakra Tantra, they say maybe has some influence from Islam, or some influence. Might not be a positive influence, it might be some tension that exists, because Tibetan Buddhism overlapped with Islam in various places, and some tension between them, some of the countries where they both coexisted. So historically, I don't know how much influence from those religions towards Buddhism. I don't think there's been much that I know of. In the other direction, where this comes into place, I think more actively and more interestingly, is in the modern era. And in the 1800s, there was Christian countries had colonized places like Sri Lanka and India. And so there was this, a lot of connections between these two, between Christian scholars, Christian theologians, Buddhism. Some of it was competitive and conflictive. Some of it was learning from each other. And some of the values of social values of Christianity influenced some of the Asian Buddhist countries. Wanted to have some similar things. So you have, for example, in places like in Southeast Asia now, for a while you had a young man's Buddhist association. It's like the young man's YMCA. So some influence there. And it gets more and more interesting, I think, in the late 1800s, 1900s, the way that Western religious ideas and Buddhist religious ideas started to influence each other. And they weren't hermetically sealed anymore the way they were before. And so now we come into the modern era here in the modern West, there are values that come out of Judeo-Christian traditions which are kind of embedded into our society and culture in ways we don't even recognize them as being Judeo-Christian anymore. That as Western Dharma teachers are trying to make their sense of Buddhism and adopt it, translate it, do what they do, some of these Western ideas, ideals, values are being kind of being pulled into Buddhism and how it's being expressed and lived here in the modern West. And some people feel like it's being changed too much, it's losing kind of the essence of Buddhism, and some people feel it's a necessary part of any adaptation to a new culture is to, you know, to somehow mix up with local values. And so for people who, you know, it's a little bit invisible unless you do some digging, a little bit digging under the surface to see how this is the case. You have to know some of the, you know, what Buddhism was originally. You have to know something about the modern era. So there are some people writing about this and studying how Western ideas are influencing Western ideas of Buddhism. And how this is going to shake out over a long term, I don't know. So this is a long, again, another, I apologize for long-winded answers. It's one of these occupational hazards. I've noticed by Buddhist teachers, the longer they teach, the more they go on. So anyways, did you have something else in mind, or is this kind of, yes.
Hi, my name is Susan. And
green light.
Yes. Just turn this way, hello.
Okay.
I'm Susan. Who is writing about that?
Who is writing about which part of this?
Well, the point I'm interested in is the influence of Western culture on Buddhism.
So the influence of Western culture on Buddhism. In terms of the history of this, back through the centuries, Stephen Batchelor wrote a book. I think it's called Awakening of the West. And he has a chapter about the connection. Around the turn of the millennia, you know, the 2,000 years ago, there was contact with Greek culture and Buddhism. And there's actually a text that survives of a Greek king who lived in the area of Afghanistan questioning a Buddhist monk. So you see these two, you know, there was a, you know, connection, contact there. But how much influence there came to Buddhism, we don't know from that king. So Stephen Batchelor writes a little bit that old history of it. And in depth, there's a book recently came out, I haven't read, but she talks about some of this called Buddhist Modernism, that talks about the West. Tanisara Bhikkhu, who teaches here sometimes, Tanjeff, he's written some articles. One of them is called Buddhist Romanticism. And the other article is called something like Understanding Buddhism Through the Bible. And he kind of argues that there's, and gives kind of references for this, of how Western Dharma teachers have been influenced by the development and trajectory of Western philosophical ideas and how they interpret Buddhism. So he's written some pointed things. But this Buddhist Modernism book talks about it some. And that's probably a good place to begin. And that book has probably have references to other earlier literature. Scholarly literature.
It just seems that
I don't think it's working.
Rock star. Yeah. Not familiar with that one. It just seems that the way that Buddhism is practiced here must be influenced very much by some of the local culture, and I just wonder about that.
Certainly how Buddhism is practiced here must be influenced by local culture. That's always been the case in Buddhism. And, you know, no matter where you go, you find cultural influences, though sometimes people think that if they, you know, that their culture must be the original or their, you know, the pure or the essence or whatever. But if you compare, you see there's all these differences and changes over time. And then the task, you know, is how do we understand what's essential? Is there an essence aside from the cultural? And so, you know, so some people who brought Buddhism to the West have chosen to leave parts of it behind because they say that's cultural. And so they try to simplify it and just do what they think is essential. But then the longer they're here, then they bring in cultural things, you know, local cultural things, and to what we do. I think it's a very important topic, especially for people who are, you know, deeply involved in this. It's a hard one, But to look at, it's not very popular to go look at your religion and your religious practices and try to look behind the surface of them, the underlying assumptions and influences that have created what you do. And in fact, probably the religions that are too, admit too loudly that they're adapting and changing and being influenced and from what was traditional, probably don't survive very long. There's a saying in the religious studies world, religions that don't change die. Religions that change and tell everyone they are die. Die out. So there's kind of a tension and dynamic around looking deeply at what actually you're doing, what we're doing, but I feel it's very important to do this because it's to be able to be responsible, because you can't help but to change. No one can help but to change it in some way. Every generation, every culture has some change, but how do you do that change responsibly? And the answer I have is to do it by trying to be very mindful of what you're doing. And you can't be mindful of what you're doing unless you know where it came from. And so there has to be some study, of the old school of what happened, and then you can see more clearly what you're doing here. So I've tried to do this, but when I bring it up among some of the other Buddhist teachers in America, this kind of idea, most of them at the best yawn and, don't understand what I'm saying. And it's an interesting thing because, some people come here to IMC and listen to me, and I'll say Buddhism says, and then you leave and you think, oh, this is what Buddhism is, because a Buddhist teacher said it. This is the way it is. But if I said, before I teach you something now about Buddhism, I'm going to describe to you what the original teaching was, the influences that affected how I learned it from my teachers and how they changed it from the original, and then what goes into my assumptions and beliefs in order to why I'm going to offer it to you, I'm going to lose you all by the time I make my point. So that's, if I, again, this is an example, if you admit too much what you're actually all about, it has no value. But if you just kind of say it more directly, this is how it is, there's something not quite honest about it either then. So how do you negotiate this is an interesting one for any Dharma teacher. And so this is one of the reasons why, we formed the Sati Center for Buddhist Studies, is to have some people who can study more deeply and look at the earlier teachings, look at the history, and look at these things. Because as people get involved, it's good to have the wider context and understanding of what we're doing. But you want to be careful that... anytime you listen to any Dharma teacher whatsoever, any descriptions of practice, any descriptions of realization, any descriptions of teachings, is a description that's going to be influenced by many, many factors, including the grammar of your language and how your particular language is organized. It's different than other languages and then cultures and all this. Okay, someone else?
Yes. My name is Carla, and this discussion was particularly meaningful to me because I consider myself a Christian who is practicing Buddhism. And as Christmas approaches, I always come face to face with the question of how personally to integrate Christianity and Buddhism. And so I wonder if you have any thoughts on that. And I also wonder, perhaps it's been fanciful of me to buy into the beliefs that Jesus was influenced by Buddhism. Is there any real evidence of that? I mean, it sounds like, from what you said, there isn't. But he just sounds so revolutionary compared to what was going on when he was born.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about the real evidence. I mean, there's supposed to be, I don't know, I mean, there's ideas, theories, where people say there's evidence, but whether it's really credible, I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, it's a little bit far-fetched, the whole thing. What we do know is that somewhere around the second or third century before Christ, there was the first Buddhist king of India named Ashoka, who kind of ruled much of what was known of India at that time. And it seems that he, if he wasn't exactly Buddhist, he was a big-time Buddhist supporter, at least Buddhist. And so it seems what he did was he sent out Buddhist missionaries, teachers, in all directions. And he was the one who sent the missionaries to Sri Lanka, and that's where Buddhism got established in Sri Lanka, is through those people he sent. And so he also sent people to the West. And how far west they got and what their impact was, and it kind of got lost. There's no records. So, you know, there's some ideas. They probably made it as far as Greece and Egypt, you know, in different areas. But whether they had any influence in those cultures, and I mean, some, there's theories. There's some people who, you know, again, all these theories, right? The Essenes. People say the Essenes are a form of Christianity that was influenced by Buddhism. And, you know, I think it's rather than trying to look and find historical connections, I think it's much more interesting to find connections of the heart. And so, you know, there's beautiful qualities of heart that Buddhists and Christians and Muslims and Jews share and emphasize. And I think to focus on those and to celebrate the beautiful qualities of the heart that we're all capable of and how different religions share and emphasize and stress, I think it brings us together and makes us all brothers and sisters much more than if we focus on, you know, the doctrinal stuff and who has it and how these influence and all that. Because it's, you know, it's the elements of the heart don't require texts, don't require, you know, this detailed study of, you know, where things came from. It's just, it's much more about what's our love, our generosity, our kindness, our things like that. And so, you know, Christmas time, has a certain, you know, in Christianity means certain things, but it also can be interpreted to mean something about generosity and community and the birth of kind of beautiful qualities. Freedom in our world. I'm not Jewish, but many years ago I was at what's the name of the Jewish holiday in the springtime?
Passover.
So there was Passover was happening during one of our retreats we were teaching, and some of the teachers in the retreat were Jewish, are Jewish, I guess, and so they had that. We had a Buddhist Passover. We had all the stuff of Passover with the salt, you know, with the salt water, I guess it is, and the horseradish, and I don't know, all the different things you do. And one of the teachers there kind of spoke the Passover thing you're supposed to do, but all through Buddhist interpretations. And it was a beautiful event. So I think it's better to... I'm much more interested in myself, the meeting of the heart, rather than the ideas. Let's have this woman in back here. Yeah.
My name's Deborah, and my question is about right livelihood. I have been not working for a year and suddenly have an opportunity to possibly have a job that will pay money and give me medical insurance, but which is not, I guess, my definition of right livelihood as I understand it. What is the best way to kind of apply this, you know, in our current situations, our current lives?
The teachings on right livelihood?
Yes.
The best way to apply it? Well, I think that, you know, to the degree to which the issues of livelihood have to do with ethics, the foundation of Buddhist ethics is don't cause harm. And so if you look at the job, will it cause harm? And is harm to you? Is it harm to others? Harm to our society? And ideally, your job would be something as a benefit to you, to others, to our society. And so to look at that is one way, that's the primary way, I think, of analyzing this, looking at this. But it gets complicated in our society because it's not black and white, the issues of harm and benefit. And so, you know, how do we negotiate the fact that it's not a black and white issue? That might be beneficial, but it also might be some harm in the very job you're doing. Just driving a car, for example, causes harm. So how do we, but most of us drive cars, so hopefully there's been some ethical reflection, consideration, and decided in the sum total that it's more beneficial to drive than it is to not drive. So there's a kind of a give and take, there's kind of a balance issue. So I would look at the job that way, and when you look at that way, you have to also then, I'd imagine, factor in the harm of not working. Is it going to push you over the edge in some kind of way, not to have an income? So maybe that harm of not having work and being pushed over the edge is far worse than the harm that's caused by a particular job. So the balance, how to work this out. And it's not easy. These questions of livelihood and appropriate livelihood and even making a living and the compromising of our values is a very difficult one. And, I remember many years ago, I participated in a kind of a conference on Buddhist ethics, and the facilitator asked those of us on the panel, I don't know if it was all of us, but asked, "What is it? What's your biggest ethical challenge as a Buddhist teacher?" And Usilananda, who was, now he's dead, but he was a beautiful Sri Lankan Burmese monk teacher who taught for about 20 years here in the Bay Area. His reply was that as a, as a caretaker, as a monk and caretaker for the Burmese lay community, he knows how hard it is for them to find work back then. They come from Burma, they have big families or families, and sometimes it was really hard to find work. And sometimes they would come to him and ask him about a job that they're applying for. It was this right livelihood. And sometimes they were... the job they were in or applying for was in a company here in the general Bay Area, companies that had connection with the military industrial business, and producing arms or some connection. So they asked him, is this the right livelihood? And he knew from the Buddhist teachings that being involved in arms production is wrong livelihood. But he also knew how hard it was for them to find work, and they had families to take care of. And that was his biggest ethical challenge, was what to say to them. It wasn't easy for him to know what to say. So, is that? Do you want to ask more now that... Is that enough? do you want to have... You've already asked one, but...
I'm still John.
Still John.
In some of the Bibles that I have at home, in the front of it, it'll have problems that you have in life, like you're lonely or unhappy or angry, and then it'll have references within the Bible to look at and read that give you some solace or guidance. Is there anything like that in the Buddhist teachings when you have a question about yourself or the world that you can... references.
Oh, I see. So an anthology that clearly has the issue, and then references where you can go read of those issues. So many years ago, someone asked me to write a book on. I think the book was supposed to be titled "What the Buddha Would Do," "What the Buddha Would Say," or something. Based on this Jesus idea. This was like in the 1990s. And I declined, but someone else wrote it. So there is such a book. I haven't seen it in bookstores, but someone did write it, What the Buddha Would Do. And there's books, so there are so many popular books in Buddhism. So, but exactly like you're saying, I don't know.
Sir Jack has to
what? I mean, you could go like Access to Insight. There's a website called Access to Insight, which is a and you can type in your word or keywords into the search function they have, and you'll pop up different both sutra references and different teachings. And it might be interesting. Audio Dharma. And if you want to listen to talks, apparently, you can. It searches the titles of the talks. You can, you know, if the titles have, if what you're interested in is in a referred to in the title of the talks on Audio Dharma, you can do a search on our Audio Dharma site and find a talk related to that topic. But probably not with the kind of detail that you're asking for. So, now probably there isn't what you're asking for. But there's a lot of books on Buddhism, so you can look at the table of contents or look in the index and you'll find something. So I think the person's... Yeah, who's it? I saw someone. Yeah. So, where's the other mic? So...
Good morning, my name's Tom. I'm new here.
I wonder if that battery is low.
My name is Alan, and I'm new here. I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about what the kinds of relationships there are between a student and a teacher, and how you know which teacher is a right teacher, and or which teachers you should, you know, study with, or if you even need a teacher.
So in this insight meditation tradition that I'm teaching in, I'll say it this way. In Buddhism, there's a range of student-teacher kinds of relationships. And it depends a little bit on what tradition you practice in. There's some Buddhist traditions where that relationship is very intense, and the level of commitment between the two is very strong. Sometimes it's traditions where it's almost like, you know, at least in popular terms, the teacher is like a guru. Sometimes they use the word guru even. And sometimes there's a very, very intense ceremonies even. Of commitment, where the student kind of commits himself to the teacher, so becomes a disciple in a sense. So that exists in Buddhism, in some schools of Buddhism. And then in the insight meditation tradition that we're part of, it's kind of like the opposite end of the spectrum. And there's a tendency to see teachers as, we use the word teacher, but there's a tendency to kind of see the teachers as good spiritual friends, as opposed to like, you know, this, you know, intense kind of guru kind of relationship. And in that regard, in our tradition, most practitioners in our tradition might have one or two teachers they feel is like, you know, their primary teacher. But there's a tendency in our tradition to study with lots of teachers. Like if you go on retreats with us, where that's one of the places where the more close connection is between people's, chances of working with only one teacher are few. And more likely you would see two teachers on a retreat, and in other retreats you'd see different teachers. And my view of this is that none of the insight meditation teachers has it all, but we kind of have it all or close to it as a package. And so it's nice to actually study with different teachers to learn the different things they have in different ways. But it's also nice to have a more primary relationship with a teacher or a couple of teachers. So they can get to know you better. And it's not made so overt or explicit in the insight meditation teacher tradition that you can do that, and it's not like advertised or encouraged even. But in fact, it's good if a teacher knows you relatively well, then they can support you in ways that are particular to you. They can give you particular advice given your situation rather than some generic thing because they don't know you. They can also challenge you, they hold you accountable if you want that, and because they know, you know, they've watched you long enough and know where you get caught, and they can say, look, there it is. And also, if you have a more of an ongoing relationship with a teacher, you also know the teacher better. And some of that goes in the other direction, too. The teacher's accountable to you now. And teacher says something, say, wait a minute, this is little bit odd here, and let's talk about it. Whereas if you don't know the teacher, you don't have a possibility for that. So that's what occurs to me, say, in brief, but if now if you want to ask more, or what interests you, or in particular, or why you asked the question, or...
Well, I just asked because I wanted to know, and I mean, I enjoy the sitting. I've done other disciplines, but I enjoy the sitting here and the feeling of it. But I'm very clear that at some point I would like some reflection from someone, you know, that I get to know over time that can say, well, I can see there's some places you're getting stuck. Here's some ideas. Mm-hmm.
So it's in our tradition, I encourage people to check around for different teachers and see who you have some respect for, some resonance with, some, it might work. Sometimes it works because of personalities. You know, so there are various reasons why things work, but or why the connection might happen, and then I think it's good to go ask the teacher, go talk to him, and say what's available in terms of working with you more closely. Are you available? Are you not available? How does it work with you? And for different teachers, it works in different ways in our tradition. So you have to talk to the particular teacher that you're interested in, say, how does it work with you? But don't wait for the teachers to say it. So is it straight back? Maybe this can be the last one.
I'm just curious. I'm Louise. And I was just sitting here thinking about...
Hold the mic.
Yeah, there. Yeah, there's been books. There's been books on this topic, and on the how Buddhism, why this generation of young people in the '60s went to Asia and practiced, and the influences there, and there's actually there's various eras of the Western culture, different ways in which people connected to Buddhism. Buddhism was very popular in the 1890s, and a lot of books published and interest and. And then it waned, and there was an upsurge in the 1950s with Zen, and especially in intellectual artistic circles. And then in the 1960s, the big interest in Buddhism among kind of Westerners really came out of the counterculture. And so the issues of the counterculture were really important, and part of it was psychedelics that had its role. Rebelling against the society had a role, looking for alternatives, feeling that certain there was a kind of a feeling at the time that Western traditions were bankrupt, and there was nothing to be found in Christianity, no practices or Judaism, looking for radical alternatives, looking for alternatives that focused on something that changed the mind, and altered states of mind, and so meditation was of interest. Looking for something exotic that was really other, because they were countercultural, right? They were against this culture, so looking for something else. So there's many factors that came into play, and some of that happened. They didn't go to India. Some people found it here. Asian teachers came here, and so they discovered it here. And then there was phases in the development and evolution of Buddhism, and not just Buddhism, but other Dharmic religions like Hinduism. How these Western converts engaged in it, very simplistically, initially it was about big experiences, and then it was a phase of buckling down and getting into the discipline of it, the discipline of inner work and change and transformation that. And like in Jack Kornfield's book, after the ecstasy, the laundry. So, if the '90s was the ecstasy, then know, if the 60s were the ecstasy, then the 70s maybe was the, more the laundry and the discipline and really kind of and creating communities and discovering communities. And then the 80s were about taking a little bit more personal responsibility because there started to be scandals in Buddhist circles. And so it wasn't just about giving all your devotion to a teacher or a guru, but starting to reflect more deeply and look into, and the issues of ethics became more important. And then also in the 80s and the 90s and since then, there's been establishments of not just intense inwardly focused communities, which they were in the 70s, but outwardly focused communities that are not just about themselves, but about, you know, also trying to serve our society and being involved in the wider community. So if you find, you know, like San Francisco Zen Center was very inwardly focused for many years, and slowly they're getting more outwardly focused into their society around them and doing outreach programs. And all of this represents partly the evolution and growth of Buddhist communities, but also the evolution and growth of individual practitioners. And so people who'd come and join Buddhism here in the West, you know, at these different decades, find themselves joining a tradition which is evolving and developing. And so now we're in the, you know, what do we call the 1910s, the 2010s. You know, there's a particular phase of growth and development of the tradition. And so people come in and they kind of, in some ways, get a jump started into a more developed phase of practice and understanding than where it was in the 1960s or 1970s. But even so, some people as individuals need to go through some of the same phase themselves. Some people need to kind of, just as a whole community of people go through a maturation development, so individuals do it too. And so there might be initially, when people come, they're focusing on particular experiences. And then after a while, they're focusing more on doing the deep inner work. And they're more introspective. And at some point, they start becoming more interested in community and being of service. And so, I don't know, so is it making some sense, what I'm saying? Yeah, enough sense? And it's all evolving and changing. And then we have, you know, people like, you know, young people like Aaron sitting here and ready to kind of, you know, kick out these old guys and, you know, and rebel. The new counterculture, these old fogies, the old hippies, you know, what do they know? And, you know, we already have that happening. You know, we have this whole generation of Dharma geeks, they're called, or Dharma, what are they called? Punks, Dharma punks, they're Dharma geeks. There's all these, you know, they differentiate themselves in different ways, and what they have in common is this kind of, you know, ready to look at the shortcomings of us old timers, and you know, and so it's fun. It's great if we can be made superfluous. Aaron's going to get it. Can we have Mike up here, Aaron? Now that I've put Aaron on his... Aaron, you want to sit up here before... Or,
I was watching a really interesting documentary recently, and one of the things that it postulated was the importance of rites of passage in cultures and how Western culture... we have a tendency to disenfranchise the elderly. And so, furthermore, they were saying, trying to tie together 2 hours of documentary here. They were saying all the wonderful social change that the hippies wanted to make in the late 60s, early 70s. They lacked the guidance because they didn't have elders. And so, in fact, that was their rite of passage. And so now the generation that's coming up, you know, maybe the folks a little earlier, they have the guidance from elders now. So it's a pretty beautiful postulate.
Beautiful. So as you replace us, we'll guide you.
I'll take
Yeah. And that's certainly the hope, right? I mean, the hope is to pass this on to the next generations. I mean, that's a really important. I mean, I see it as an important function of myself as a teacher, as a getting elderly myself now, and but also as a, you know, as a center like this. I mean, it isn't just, you know, I don't see it as only taking care of the people who come, but an important part of taking care of the people who come is also taking care of the kind of the people who are coming and the next generation. And so there's already thoughts and plans, some plans and thoughts about how to also create an institution or organization that can pass it on. And I'm looking for people who to pass it on too. I'm looking for people the next generation. And so please, you know, rebel. You know, if there's not enough rebellion, I mean, then, you know, how can I trust you? So anyway, so thank you for today. It was nice to hear your concerns and interest, and I hope that it was interesting for enough of you to hear this. And happy holidays.